Never would have hitchhiked to Birmingham if it hadn't been for love.
Brian, have you ever wondered how this all started? Why we are here and where we came from?
Yeah, I had that talk with my dad when I was 12.
No, I don't mean that. I mean how all this came to be.
You're really starting us off real existential tonight.
In the beginning, there was little Lindsay Park sitting at her computer desk she had purchased at Shopko, Rest in Power Shopko. And she was a young Mormon mommy out in Stansbury Park.
Okay, I see. You're talking about the beginning of this podcast.
Of course. What else would I be talking about? Yes, I was just living the rural life in Stansbury Park in Tooele County, and of course, I was curious and in pain about Mormon history, and I started the Year of Polygamy podcast, and it wasn't long before I met you, and we were off to the races.
And now we have a podcast.
The point is, though, that I was living in Stansbury Park. I spent 12 tumultuous years there in that tiny little rural town in the middle of nowhere. Have you ever been there?
I have, once.
When?
The girl that I was madly in love with in high school, her parents moved there. And so
there were like three houses then.
There were not many. I remember
like along
it
the
was
lake.
Literally in the middle of nowhere. We went there for New Year's. I had been home from a mission about 3 days. Once.
Was she on the lake?
Seems like. I remember we got out there. It was dark by the time we were there, so it was hard to see, but I think so.
Well, I was born in Murray, Utah, and in Murray, we looked our noses down at Tooele County. So when I moved out there, I was embarrassed for a long time to say I lived in Tooele, but I was less embarrassed to say Stansbury Park. First of all, no one knew where it was, and it sounded very English to me, like sophisticated and regal. People would be like, oh, you live in Tooele? And I would say, no, I live in Stansbury Park.
Stansbury Park. And we meet no shade here, Tooele.
Well, some shade. Get your act together, McDonald's in downtown Tooele. Anyway, like I said, I've always imagined the town name to be descended from some European town. I was very proud of it. And so imagine my surprise when I realized Stansbury Park, Stansbury Island, and all those Stansbury-named things in the West Desert were named for a Gentile government Pinkerton.
I mean, you're talking about Howard Stansbury. Pretty sure he wasn't a Pinkerton.
Doesn't matter. He was a federal man, Americat, if you will. A great among the U.S. Army Corps of Topographical Engineers. And he's the entrance to today's episode.
Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned morphine. That's good enough for me.
You'll just do anything to talk about Stansbury Park, won't you?
No, I'm serious. This is important history. I don't think people realize how important Howard Stansbury was to the Mormons. So we're going to dig into this today. And just a warning, it's going to be a long one. I got sucked into this history.
Fine. But first, a word from our sponsors. Because you know who would appreciate a good Stansbury discussion? Mr. Dale Morgan.
Richard Saunders has completed the first biography of Dale L. Morgan, preeminent Western historian of the fur trade, historic trails, and the Latter-day Saint movement. The book explores how, despite personal struggles, Morgan committed his life to tracking down sources and interpreting the past on the strength of documentary evidence. Connecting Morgan's life with some of the broad cultural changes that shaped his experience, this book engages with methodological shifts in the historical profession, the mid-20th century collision of interpretations within Latter-day Saint history, and the development of a descriptive, scholarly approach to that history. Morgan's body of work and commitment to serious scholarship signaled the start of new ways of understanding, studying, and retelling history, and he motivated a generation of historians from the 1930s to the 1970s to transform their historical approaches. Sounding board mentor and close friend to Nels Anderson, Fawn Brody, Juanita Brooks, Bernard DeVoto, Wallace Stegner, and Leonard Arrington, Dale Morgan is the common factor linking the influential generation of mid-20th century historians of Western America. Dale L. Morgan, Mormon and Western Histories in Transition by Richard L. Saunders, new from the University of Utah Press. Check them out at uofupress.com. Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan,
bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion,
this isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
So, who is Howard Stansberry, and why do we care?
The million-dollar question for this podcast.
All right, before we get to him, let's talk about what America was doing in 1849 when the Mormons were over in Utah Territory battling crickets and worshiping seagulls.
In the early part of the 19th century, the American government was worried about getting their collective shiz together. Because remember, they had recently just won their independence and they were like, oh good, we have a country. Now what? So they're trying to organize things and it was a rocky start. Remember how we talked about how disorganized the military was, for example? So the country was just this toddler, and the majority of their time in the early 1800s were focused on helping the newly formed states figure things out.
When it came to the western part of the continent, most of it, of course, didn't belong to the U.S. yet. West of the Mississippi was Indian country or land owned by Mexico. The U.S. government was interested in exploration and surveying the area, but it's mostly being explored at that point by private individuals, fur trappers, businessmen, traders who wore buckskin and beaver tail hats, that kind of thing.
So the government-sponsored exploration beginning in the early 1800s, and you may have heard of a few of those folks, say the Lewis and Clark expedition.
In 1803, the United States purchased a huge swath of land from French colonizers. It's basically Missouri to Colorado, and then Montana down to Louisiana. It's known, of course, as the Louisiana Purchase. After this happened, Thomas Jefferson, who was president at this time, commissioned the Lewis and Clark expedition. He's hoping to find a trade route that connected the East and West coasts, but also to establish American dominance in this continent that's largely controlled by the French and the Spanish.
So yes, the main goal was power and money, but the sales pitch was a little bit sexier. Jefferson hoped to make it a scientific mission.
I love that scientific mission to you as the sexier pitch. That's fantastic.
I think it is. Because they're there to study the geography, the plants, and better understand the indigenous tribes in the area. And by better understand, I mean he wanted to know which ones would be a threat to American supremacy. So Jefferson had long been interested in these goals dating back to the 1700s, but after the Louisiana Purchase, it was made a lot easier.
Jefferson decides to form a group called the Corps of Discovery and plan to use U.S. Army resources. So he picks two Army dudes to lead the party going west. Captain Meriwether Lewis and Second Lieutenant William Clark will lead a group of 33 of the nation's top hunters, trappers, and explorers on a two-year expedition through the Great Plains and the Rocky Mountains.
And both the leaders are Virginia men.
Sure, wah-wah, wah-wah, whatever. Again, we're pretending to be all sciencey. Look, here's my microscope. But it's really about commerce and the U.S. preparing to claim the entire continent. Of course, I'm sure you've heard of Sacagawea. She's born near Lemhi in Idaho. She's a member of the Shoshone Band. She'd been kidnapped by Spanish slavers. And then she gets sold to this really shitty French-American dude named Toussaint Charbonneau, who made her his forced wife. P.S. She's about 13 at the time. Charbonneau is pretty much useless, but Sacagawea would be an integral part of the entire expedition.
Anyway, that expedition proved to be pretty fruitful to American interests. And after that, the government ordered Zebulon Pike to go on an expedition to find the source of the Mississippi River. And then in the 1840s, when the Mormons were still in Nauvoo, then the U.S. Army has a guy named Charles C. Fremont. He's a senator who has a nephew called John C. Fremont, who they send out to explore the West. And we've pulled from his journals more than a few times now because he recorded some of the first white reactions to indigenous tribes in the Utah Territory where the Mormons would settle. Plus, Juanita Brooks studied and wrote about him quite a bit, and although colonization is a complicated animal, Fremont stuff is important to know if you want to understand anything about the American West.
So with all that background now, it's time to talk about our main course, Howard Stansberry.
Thank you.
As more and more settlers become interested in the West after the expeditions that we just talked about, the United States' focus shifted as well. It wasn't long before gold was discovered in California, and the Mormons had already settled the Utah Valley, so now the Army's focus was less on exploring and more on surveying. They wanted to know who controlled what land and what resources were available for the taking.
Just a few months after the Mormons get to the Salt Lake Valley, the U.S. war with Mexico ends and the U.S. purchased the area.
With slavery proceeds.
With slavery proceeds. So Utah Territory becomes part of the U.S., much to the disappointment of the Mormons who are trying to escape the U.S. And it's not long after that, maybe a little over a year, that the Army decides to send another group of men out to survey the area.
And that's where Mr. Howard Stansberry comes in.
Stansberry's born and raised in New York and starts a career as a civil engineer. He joins the U.S. newly formed Topographical Bureau in 1828, and he got really good by surveying several rivers. By 1838, he had joined the U.S. Corps of Topographical Engineers as a first lieutenant. He studies the Great Lakes, and then he serves at the Gulf of Mexico during the Mexican War.
And as soon as the war ended, he received orders from Colonel John J. Albert, who was running the Army's Topographical Bureau. The orders were to go west and to make a map of the Great Salt Lake Valley. And while he was there, he was supposed to survey the area and figure out what tribes lived there and how to establish a trade route through to California. And his second in command was a man whose name you need to know, Lieutenant John W. Gunnison. Remember that name because he'll become important just a little later on. And the expedition they go on to survey this place would last about 2 years and they cover a lot of ground.
Here's the thing about that though. If I know anything about Mormons, and I might, they are not going to be happy knowing a huge group of U.S. Army dudes are coming through their territory. The group arrives at Fort Bridger, and then their guide Jim Bridger took them through what is now Ogden Canyon, through the North Ogden Divide to the Salt Lake Valley. When the group arrived, the Mormons were anything but gracious hosts. Here's what Stansberry records of their arrival.
Quote, upon requesting food and lodging for the night, we were told to our great surprise that we could not be accommodated, nor would the occupants sell us so much as an egg or a cup of milk, so that we obliged to remount our horse and we actually bivouacked under some willows within 100 yards of this inhospitable dwelling of the surly Nabal. What's bivouacked mean?
So that's the camp there, basically.
What a cool name. I'm going to start using that now. Bivouac.
Nabal is kind of fun, too, because it's a biblical character, and he's like, you know, this sort of stereotypical stingy dude who won't give you anything.
That's the Mormons.
That's a nice...
To the Gentiles.
Nice character to throw in there. So the next day, Stansberry rode into Salt Lake to meet with Brigham Young to see if he could barter a little more friendly relationship with the Mormons. He's going to have to be here for a while. Brigham Young shows up to the meeting with our old buddy, Albert Carrington, who will later be an apostle and head of the Perv Division in England. That's a fun story. I mean, fun in our sense of the word fun. We always have to qualify that.
Fun in a walking across the plains when you're pregnant fun.
Exactly. That kind of fun. At this point, Carrington is serving as Brigham Young's personal secretary, and Brigham wants Carrington to go along and, you know, see what they're doing, maybe report back to me, you know, maybe be a spy.
He's definitely a spy. We'll come to that. Here's what John Gunnison records about the meeting, quote, we had a few moments to talk about our survey. Under much apparent indifference, Brigham Young showed anxiety, and I hear from various sources that our survey is regarded with great jealousy and have had warned what secret means would be used to prevent any maps being made of the valley, even that our lives are in danger, as a hint from the one man could take them. So yeah, Mormons did not have a good reputation at this point in American history, and Gunnison and their men were actually worried that they'd be, you know, murdered by the Mormons.
Now, Howard Stansberry had to do what Jefferson had hoped his best surveyors would do, pretend they were there for the science and not for the domination. Of course, they're not really fooling anybody. Stansberry writes that, quote, the impression was that a survey was to be made of their country in the same manner that other public lands are surveyed, for the purpose of dividing it into townships and sections, and thus establishing and recording the claims of the government to it, and thereby anticipating any claims the Mormons might set up from their previous occupation.
So the meeting finally ends somewhat well. Stansberry agrees to hire Albert Carrington as a chief assistant to the survey. That's what they're calling it these days. But Albert Carrington wasn't fooling anyone. It's very clear he was a spy. And if you think we're exaggerating using that word, Young's private letters show that Carrington being there, quote, will enable us to know at all times what their movements and discoveries are. Captain Stansberry expressed feelings and appearances are very friendly. And Brigham Young's writing this to M.S. Lyman.
So that's that. The Mormons and the army will pretend to kumbaya together. Gunnison took Albert Carrington to survey the Jordan River, and Stansbury took some men to explore the north shores of the Great Salt Lake. This was kind of a big deal for white people to survey the Great Salt Lake.
We get it. White people don't know how to use spices. I'm glad they get to figure out salt.
No, it's not really the salt part. It's the lake part. Because white exploration really hadn't done much around the Great Salt Lake. Several mountain men had tried, but the unusual conditions of the lake were very hard on pack animals. Gee, no kidding. Cars don't do any better out there.
What, your cattle doesn't want to eat, salt dirt?
Captain, my animal seems to be melting. Is that normal? Yeah, the weather in Utah is always a challenge, and so are the Shoshone. But Stansberry and his men did it. Their maps weren't always accurate, but their first survey of the lake shores in October 1849 proved to be successful.
And the rest of the trip proved mostly according to plan. Of course, there was an incident, which we have covered in the last couple of episodes, the battle at Fort Utah, or better called the Massacre of the Timpanogos people, but incident is the word that Mormon historians use. When Brigham Young ordered their extermination, Howard Stansberry gave his full support of the campaign, and he wanted to both please his new Mormon friends and protect his surveyors from these dangerous Indians. He even sends two of his men to help assist the Mormons to kill the Timpanogos, Dr. James Blake, a physician, and Lieutenant George Howland.
And this physician, Dr. Blake, proved to be a bad gamble for Stansberry. You might remember this guy. He's the dude that asked to cut off the heads of the murdered Timpanogos so he could send them back to Washington for study. And if you don't get that reference, you say sorry. Back up a couple episodes, listen to our Battle of Fort Utah discussion. Stansberry didn't care about that so much. He did care that Dr. Blake was doing a side hustle. He'd opened a private practice in Salt Lake and was using military time to treat the Mormons. After being on the Little Massacre trip, he asked Stansberry to pay him $123 for his work there.
So Stansberry demurs on paying such a sum, and Dr. Blake sues the expedition for $1,436 in back pay, and this, of course, pisses Stansberry off, and he refuses to pay. So Dr. Blake isn't doing well. He's not making friends with the Mormons either. They actually back Stansberry between his feud with Dr. Blake, and so when the court goes before the Mormon Justice of the Peace, they rule against Blake. They found that the doctor had taken his notes and medical instruments and buried them in the garden, and he'd also tried to fudge the books and hide some of his crimes in the massacre. So when the Mormons ruled against Blake, he took it to the Secretary of War, who refused to pay him for his part in the Salt Lake City expedition. So Blake goes to California and begins what all the angry, disgruntled Gentiles do, and he publishes anti-Mormon literature on how perverted the Mormons were. Said from the guy who cut off a shiz ton of heads and tried to convince the Mormons that rotten duck confit was a thing.
When spring 1850 came, Stansberry and Gunnison wanted to really focus their efforts on a solid survey of the Great Salt Lake. The work he did this time was truly impressive, and thanks to that, we have a lot of early glimpses of the area during that time.
And Gunnison is interesting because he surveys faithfully the area in northern Utah, most notably by the Bear River area, and this of course is going to open up the army to some horrible stuff in just a decade or so for the Bear River Massacre, where the U.S. Army under Colonel Patrick Connor absolutely brutalizes and slaughters hundreds of peaceful Shoshone. But John Gunnison would also be known later for a massacre by his own name, the Gunnison Massacre. And we, of course, will get to that in just a minute.
You're such a massacre tease.
Gunnison and Albert Carrington didn't always get along, by the way, at least in my humble opinion, although all the Mormon histories will say that they did. Albert Carrington complained that he felt like Gunnison and Stansberry were too lax in their military duties and acted too much like scientists. He would write to Brigham and be like, they don't know how to be an army. He says it like it's a bad thing. And this is where it gets interesting to me. Permission to rant on a tangent?
I mean, we've come this far.
So Brigham Young writes to Amasa Lyman in 1852 that the Mormons are giving the U.S. government Albert Carrington as a spy. We know this is the initial agreement. We also know that Stansberry and Gunnison didn't trust the Mormons and had been warned that they were going to be killed. So this is the premise that they all enter this lovey-dovey relationship, and then Carrington, as a spy, goes with these guys and he's in with them for several months on the expedition and even tries to help them write the reports. But some accounts have Carrington complaining to Brigham Young about how stupid and inept the government is. But then I will read, you know, histories like Brigham M. Matson's history on it. And Brigham M. Matson is a smart dude, yeah? And Matson writes about Gunnison and Carrington as if they've had some grand love affair. And Matson would know, since he edited two journals of letters between the two, he has been knee-deep in the primary documents. And he writes as if Carrington and Gunnison were beloved friends. And at first blush, their letters seem that way. But before I get into my take, Brian, talk to me about Brigham Matson as a historian.
So Brig's interesting. One thing, see, sadly, he died before I was kind of in these circles. I found it interesting that he was 6'4". Oh, tall, wow. Mormon historians. We like them. So he starts his career at BYU, but then after only 6 years, he clashes over academic freedom. These are the Ernest Wilkinson years, after all. He ends up resigning. He goes and works in construction for a while, goes to Utah State, but then he eventually ends up at the U, where he'll spend the rest of his career. And as far as his Mormonness goes, he's kind of always a skeptic. He does serve a mission, but over the course of his life, he always has questions, right? He edits the B.H. Roberts Studies of the Book of Mormon, so he'll be one of those that's kind of looked on questioningly by Joseph Fielding Smith, guys like that. So his main area of research was Western history, and particularly indigenous people.
Well, I bring this up not to criticize Brigham Matson, because like I said, his history is good. Like, without his work, I wouldn't even be able to access a lot of these documents. But I really wanted to try to understand more about Carrington's relationship with Stansberry and Gunnison. It's actually important to this story, not because it's just a salacious story about the Mormons infiltrating the government with spies, but because the Stansberry expedition is really the first big example of government encroachment in the Utah Territory. And as we build up to the Utah War, I want to understand as many facets as possible.
If you read Matson's work on Albert Carrington's relationship with the expedition, it definitely seems like his telling it's this honeymoon match.
Yes. So for context, would you mind reading one of the letters? Because you can see that there's like, it's very flowery to each other.
Yep, here we go. Check this out. My dear Carrington, your highly esteemed favor of June was received by me a few days since, and it did me a great deal of good, as well as improvement in topographical knowledge of your country. All your explorations possess great interest for me, and I can seem to follow you and see all the hills, ravines, and lakes which you well described. Indeed, the mountain scenery is indelibly impressed upon my mind, and the trip to the Salt Lake will no doubt be the crowning incident for the page of individual memory. You flatter me by the confidence in which yourself and the respected presidency and others have expressed themselves. Some have gone so far among the Gentiles as to censure me for partiality. Even Captain Lee, whom you know and esteem, says I have praised the Mormons too highly. But I shall want to hear the criticisms of the Utahs, and then be better able to judge whether I have obtained the object of holding even the scales of justice between the two parties as an impartial looker. On no doubt, you will secure a copy of my notes before this, and I beg you to send me the news if it publishes any remarks, no matter how severe. One copy has been sent to me. One copy has been sent to me only. It is full of verbal errors, but nothing to materially alter the sense. I am so out of the world in these wild woods that it is out of my power to send you an account of the doings in the peopled world, other than is common to both of us, namely the newspaper when we get them.
Thanks. Okay, so right, most of the letters are like this. Lots of, my dear and my esteemed friend, and the Mormons are so cool and so misunderstood. And maybe this is evident to everyone except Brigham and M. Matson, but I don't read these two as having a sincere friendship. Like, no doubt they got along well enough, but I read a lot of ass-kissing, manipulation, and strategy here. Am I wrong? I mean, Carrington was called to join the group as a spy to help Mormon interests, and that's what he's always going to be loyal to. And of course, Gunnison and Stansberry are invested in having a good relationship with the Mormons, so I read their letters as a lot of performative friendship. At the very least, friendship as secondary to their primary initiatives. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're probably right there. Outside of maybe Thomas Kane, Mormons don't really develop actual friendships with outsiders. The siege mentality is just too strong in early Utah. And I do think that framework of all these parties just scheming for their own interests is unavoidable. Now, I will say Stansberry and Gunnison, compared to other federal officials in town, and especially later, do seem to try harder to get along with the Mormons, but painting it as a warm friendship, as Madsen does in one place, is probably too much. Amicable, which he uses later, seems more accurate.
Okay, rant over. I think I just wanted to push back on the narrative that Stansberry and Gunnison were hunky-dory with the Mormons. Especially when we get into some of the alternative theories about Gunnison's interactions with the Mormons after this expedition and ultimately his death.
Spoiler alert.
Sorry, back to business.
A good morning, little schoolgirl. Can I go home with you? Tell your mama and your daddy I'm a little schoolboy too.
Babe, the Stansberry expedition was a success as far as scientific surveying went, because it helps researchers understand better how rivers and mountain snow system works in the West. It's a pretty solid first attempt at mapping the area, and opens up the Mormons to the idea that the U.S. government is going to come in, they're not going to go away.
You know, we keep teasing that we're going to talk about the Gunnison Massacre. Why do that? It's mean. It's un-American. Why don't we just buckle up and get into it here? And we're going to break a cardinal rule and go forward in time first. And on this podcast, even though we're still in the 1850s, early 1850s, we're going to jump forward 3 to 6 years just for this episode. Don't worry, we'll back up and give you plenty more context for all the things we're talking about.
Oh, sure. If Brian wants to jump ahead and talk about fundamentalist history, everyone makes
that's
a federal
like a,
case
like
about it.
That's like a century later. Slow down.
That's, well, stop like 50, time shaming
quarter,
me here.
Quarter century. Half century.
Fine. All right. We're doing it. Here we go. Set your minds to the early 1850s. Salt Lake City's only 6 years old. If you picture it, obviously at this point, it's a very small frontier town. As historian Josiah Gibbs later points out about this time, the church newspaper, the Deseret News, that was mentioned in the letter, is up and running, but it's small. It barely has enough resources to publish once a week. Rag paper, by definition, requires rags, and those are always in short supply. Fun fact, they would call people on rag missions. Jeremy, go around and collect
Jeremy
rags.
Jeremy Tucker knows a lot about that.
But you don't get to use napalm with these rags, so it's not as fun.
That's a Kingston joke. Okay, continue.
So if these events would have happened just a decade later, the response would have been plastered across the country. But at this early point of Utah territory, a lot of bad, bad stuff just flies under the radar.
South of Salt Lake City is an even newer settlement, about 2 years old in 1853, in Pavant Valley, now known as Millard County. A man named Anson Call was a bishop of the area, and who was Anson Call, Brian?
So Anson Call is a Vermonter by birth, then the family moves near Kirtland when he's a kid, so they're early converts to Mormonism, about 1831. And then they do the traditional Kirtland, then to Far West, then to Nauvoo route. It's in Nauvoo where the most famous event that's always associated with him happens. This is where Joseph Smith allegedly says in 1842 that, quote, the saints would yet go to the Rocky Mountains. That might sound familiar because we've talked about that a couple times. We've already registered our raised eyebrows votes. I don't think it's super credible. Sorry.
It's funny because I got criticized on the John DeLynn podcast for saying the Mormons had no idea where they're going. And just as, since we're ranting, I love that everyone's always trying to correct me and my history. You say something, they're like, oh, a man said it. It must be true. But Lindsay says that they're like, we would like to see your sources, please. That's Mormonism for you.
I would argue that I just chew my gum and flip my hair better.
You probably do. We're always laughing whenever there's like takedown videos, 3-hour takedown videos. Do you think Brian gets mentioned at all by our critics? What gives?
I feel like there's something. The letters XX and XY come to mind. I don't know if those are related. Now, the last important thing about Anson Call is that after he comes to Utah, he is then the bishop of Fillmore.
This guy is the bishop of this young Mormon township. This area was really important because a new trail that headed to Southern California to the gold fields went through this area, and this is near Fillmore, Utah, which is going to become the territory's capital for a time.
Only for a time.
Yes, but what a time it was. And we'll get into that episode soon as well. Anyway, near this area is a place called Corn Creek, and it's inhabited by a group of Pavant Utes. Pa meaning water, Vant means dry, so like the water's gone. Pavant Utes, and it's soon going to be turned into a colonized farm where Mormons try to get the Utes to learn how to farm, and it doesn't go well. We'll get into that soon too. But for now, know that to go through this area, to California, you have to pass through Pahvant territory. And the chiefs of the group, like Kanash and Moshe Kuwap, lived. They assured everyone that white Mormons and white non-Mormons, now called Marikats by the Utes, would have safe passage through the area.
So here's the traditional story of what's about to follow that's based on the stories of the residents of Millard County who were there at the time. In October 1853, a group of non-Mormon immigrants are coming through on the road to California. Bishop Anselm Call tells them about the Utes camping nearby and tells them to be peaceful and friendly. Right away, the groups try to trade with one another. As they're trading buckskins, tobacco, animal skins, things like that, the immigrants are nervous about the Utes having weapons on them. So they try to disarm them of their bows and arrows. This does not go well.
So I'm going to tell you an account, but of course, this account is questioned by other accounts. It's very hard to get an exact account of what happened. But the general story is the father of one of the leaders of this band of Pahvant, it's Moshe Kuwap's father, holds the tip of his arrow to the chest of one of the immigrants, threatening to take away their weapons. In some accounts, they say that he like poked him through the side, like slashed him. And the white man responds by fatally shooting Moshe Kuwap's father. And this starts a brawl, and two Utes were injured, and Kanash breaks up the fight. But of course, Moshe Kuwap was furious and grieving that his father had been so ruthlessly murdered. And there's another version of the death that circulates. Like I said, it's that the Utes were begging the immigrants for food and were being saucy.
There's no worse offense in the 19th century.
You know what? If you're a saucy Ute, they use it several times to justify this. And the immigrants were terrified and harassed by this band for several days, and finally let the band stay in their camp if they retired their weapons, because they trusted them if they could watch them sleep. So the first Ute gave up his bow and arrow willingly, but the second, his name is Tonif or Toby, and he's supposed to be Moshe Kuwap's father, refused and drove his arrow through the side of an immigrant who, thinking he was dying, shot Tonif. Then they tied Tonif up to a wagon wheel as a hostage, and he's bleeding out. He's been shot. And he dies in the night. And this means three Pahvants are ultimately killed in the exchange. So it's just so tricky because there are so many varying accounts of what happened that it's hard to tell what's real. Anson Call claims to have chased down the wagon train to hear what happened, and they told him that they tried to trade with kindness. But others showed that the group behaved really horrible to the Pahvants, even tying Tonif to the wagon wheel by his neck and beating him before he died.
The Pahvants were said to go and meet with Anson Call, who was also serving as an Indian farmer, pointing out that these immigrants are from Missouri, and therefore they share a common enemy. Anson Call tries to keep peace between both parties, according to the Mormon sources, of course. Meanwhile, John Gunnison is back in Utah. After surveying the Great Salt Lake, he gets promoted. This time, he's on yet another expedition to look for a good place to lay the railroad in the area. But by October, he's running out of time on the mapping project, and he's in a hurry to get the survey done before the snow hits.
And we forgot to mention earlier that John Gunnison also decides to write and publish a book on the Mormons, which we will link scans of in the show notes. And I decided to read this book for the sake of this podcast, so it took me forever. You know, I needed to see how Gunnison portrayed the Mormons at this time, him being best friends with Albert Carrington and all.
So in the preface, written in July 1852, he calls the Mormons strange and interesting. He promises to try to not criticize or praise the Mormons, but just write them as they are and let the reader decide their character.
What's most interesting is he claims that Mormonism is something that is influencing 500,000 souls. I would be curious if he meant the Mormons themselves or just their impact, because as future federal appointees will point out to Brigham Young several times, having a fair and accurate census is what the government needs. Not exaggeration, Brigham. But actually, in the book, he mentions he thinks there's about 30,000 Mormons living in Utah at the time, and thousands more in the Pacific Islands, and thousands in England. But he also acknowledges that he knows the Mormons are fudging the numbers.
What's even more interesting is how Gunnison is trying to pull a Thomas Kane by trying to write about the Mormons favorably, but at times he can't help being condescending. Listen to Gunnison also pull a Gordon Hinckley with this quote. The Latter-day Saints pretend to derive the word Mormon from the Gaelic and a branch of the Teutonic dialects, compounding it from more, or great, and from mon, signifying good, and therefore it imports more good or great good. Now, where did he get that little gem? This is certainly from a statement that's published in Joseph Smith's name in Nauvoo, but it's probably a W.W. Phelps production. Gunnison then plays linguist himself with this. Mormon. Mormonos Greek signifies a female specter, a phantom, or hideous monster. The Greek word he's after is actually mormo, but we'll applaud his effort.
Ooh, where was Hinckley on that interpretation? I like the spooky female specter interpretation. That really resonates with me. I also like how Gunnison points out that, quote, these two definitions may be deemed to convey different opinions of supporters and opposers of Mormonism. Don't we know it?
Gunnison paints them as trying to be good American citizens, paying taxes, organized like other American societies, but he does admit there is tension between their goals and the government's goals.
Tension. He says that the Mormons delight to call their government a theodemocracy, and after painting them as normal Americans, goes into great detail about their absolute inability to separate church and state. But like Thomas Kane, he doesn't write about it with too much judgment, so I can see Mormons being proud of the fact. It's actually pretty sneaky, but you can tell there's a little edge to what he's saying. Honestly, the book is really long, but I think it's worth reading if you want to understand this period in history, because Gunnison spends a lot of ink on the descriptions of the territory, almost as if he loved to make maps of things. But his impressions of the Mormons seem very generous and fair. His discussion of their doctrine, I think, is very accurate and fair. He quotes the articles of faith, and he talks about their beliefs, and he also acknowledges that they were a threat to American democracy.
What was that thing you're telling me? That like there's this weird fanfic of him where he, as a topographer, will describe his lovers in great detail and
stop it. Just stop it.
The beast of America lay down like a naked dead body, keep it real for the people.
So again, back to the new expedition job in Utah to survey for a future railroad route. John Gunnison actually beats out John C. Fremont, whose fancy uncle was trying to get Fremont the appointment, but no dice. This job went to Gunnison this time, who was really passionate about a central line that he thought would work through Utah, and he was really excited because he's like, the Mormons are going to love it. It's going to help Mormon commerce. Mormons did not want... did not want people coming through their territory. But Gunnison had with him a team of hardy scientists to prove his theory. Jacob Kruitzfeldt, who was a botanist, R.W. Kern, who was an artist and topographer, and they had a military escort led by Captain R.M. Morris, and they employed a Mormon guy, William Potter, who was acting as their guide. And when the group made it to Millard County, it's now mid-October, and the skirmish with the immigrants and the Utes, the Pawans, had happened just a few weeks before. So Gunnison made a visit to Anson Call, and the two were said to be pals from meeting earlier.
The story from the Mormon side goes that Anson Call told Gunnison of the troubles earlier in the month, and told him the band that was involved in the dispute had disappeared, but he warns Gunnison to be careful. Gunnison and his men plan to split up so they could get their work done faster. So they divide into two teams. 11 men followed Gunnison further downstream from the Sevier River. Then on October 26, 1853, several of Gunnison's men were duck hunting, and their guns alerted the band of Pawan Utes, who were allegedly lying in wait to take revenge for the murder of Moshe Quap.
And now, in an effort to try and include as many indigenous voices as possible, I'm going to halfway do that, going to read an account that is said comes from one of the participants of the Gunnison Massacre, and I said is said because the obtaining and recording of it is a bit dubious and can't be corroborated in the same way with the same ethics as academics try to record oral histories now. So take it for what it's worth. This is a white person recording on what he claimed he heard from a Pawan Ute named Marir. I'm also going to point out that this was supposedly recorded in the late 1890s, so the racist language reflects that. This is a 1928 history, I'm using history in air quotes, recorded by Josiah Gibbs that he started compiling in 1894 after interviewing Marir.
Quote, seemingly anxious to palliate the crime, Marir told the story of the murder of Moshe Quap's father, of which he was a witness, and then named the participants. They were Moshe Quap, Ponce, Marir, and his brother Jim, Carbororitz, Nunkibulitz, Tom Wants and his son Kunants, Shipoke, Dr. Jacob, Wabitz, Moab, Sam and his brother Todi, Hunkotuap, Bokubitz, and Jimmy Knights, an unusually tricky Indian, well known to the early cattle raisers for the skill and boldness he exhibited in stealing their stock. There were also two Snake Valley Indians, a Ute from Nephi, one whose name Marir could not remember, and Marir's father. With the pencil, Marir indicated a group of lakelets about 8 miles westerly from the herein before described depression and a mile or two north of the river as the camp of the warriors. He then began his narrative, which follows. During the early afternoon of October 25th, the white man's date, Sam and Toadie, armed with bows and arrows, were hunting ducks and rabbits on the south side of the river, a couple of miles or so below Deseret. They were startled by the reports of firearms from the north side of the river. Peering through the willows, the red men saw a small number of horsemen, a few of whom wore United States military uniforms, which proved they were Marakats. Trailing in the rear of the horsemen was an improvised cart on which was packed bedding, provisions, and camp utensils. The soldiers were firing at the flocks of ducks, then moving southward. Within the shelter of the willows, the Indians watched the movements of the white men until Captain Gunnison and comrades entered their last campground. After carefully observing the details of the camp, Sam and Toadie hurried down the river and told Moshe Quap of their discovery. The opportunity for avenging his father's death had unexpectedly arrived, and Moshe Quap lost no time in planning the details of the attack. It was about midnight when the Braves left the camp for their encampment of the white men. Without hesitation, Maria traced the sinuous trail of the red men out to the river, thence up the north bank to the inlet in the southwest corner of the depression, where Moshe Quap halted and gave his final instructions.
The war chief, accompanied by Pants, Marir, Karboritz, Nunca Bulitz, and several others in crossing the inlet, covered with a thin sheet of ice, got their feet wet, which Marir distinctly remembered as the only disagreeable incident. While sitting motionless during the remainder of that chill October night, they awaited the fatal signal. Stealthily working their way through the willows on the north bank of the river to the Gunnison camp, Moshe Quap, Marir, and others secreted themselves in clumps of willows not more than 100 feet west of where the explorers were soundly sleeping. Karboritz took his assigned position on the riverbank a few yards west of the trail made by the white men from their campfire in going to and fro for the water. The other warriors skirted the north side of the depression and, turning south, completed the deadly cordon. Karboritz had been selected to fire the signal gun at the instant the first rays of the sun should strike the camp. It was a few minutes before sunrise when the cook lighted the campfire over which he placed the iron tripods and kettles. Professors Kern and Kreutzfeldt were standing by the fire while the corporal and his men were caring for the horses 100 yards or so northwest of the campfire where the previous evening they had been picketed among the clumps of willows. Captain Gunnison had walked out to the river not more than 50 feet distant and in a stooping position was bathing his hands and face. Startled by the click of Karboritz's gun as he raised the hammer, the captain sprang to his feet and the bullet passed harmlessly by. Kern, Kreutzfeldt, and the cook fell dead beside the campfire, pierced with bullets from the guns of Moshe Quap, Pants, Marir, and others.
Captain Gunnison, having emptied his revolver at Karboritz, who, illustrated in pantomime by Marir, ducked and dodged with such agility as to escape injury, turned toward the terrifying babel of war whoops, shouts of victory, cries for help from those wounded during the first discharge of arrows, and yells from the confused survivors, some of whom were moving the horses to fresh pasturage or were racing towards their mounts. The corporal and a private leaped on their horses and, by keeping within the clumps of willows, reached the higher ground to north and escaped. Another private ran to the river, plunged in, reached the opposite bank, secreted himself, and during the afternoon reached the camp at Gunnison Bend. Reaching the scene of slaughter, Gunnison realized that all was lost and that his only course, if possible, was that of escape from the heartbreaking scene. Pursued by a shower of deadly arrows, the captain, doubtless with the hope of securing his saddle horse, ran towards the northwest and disappeared within the willows.
Some 2 or 3 hours after the firing of the signal gun, Marir and a few companions began search of the willows 100 yards or so to northwest for additional plunder. The red men were surprised at discovering a white man who had been wounded by arrows lying full length on the sward, now marked with crimson stains. Several arrows lying about proved that the wounded man had wrenched them from his body. At the appearance of the Indians, the white man slowly and painfully raised himself to sitting position. Marir alone recognized Gunnison, but remained silent. Not even Moshe Quap, until 11 days after the massacre, knew of the captain's presence within the expedition. Extending his hands, palms up in a mute appeal for mercy, Captain Gunnison awaited the verdict. The red men hesitated. There was something in that silent appeal that touched a stranger in the hearts of the also-silent red men. Suddenly, Jimmy Knight, the renegade Indian, appeared and, without speaking, raised his gun and fired. The captain's body swayed and then sank to the ground.
Well, I'm digging my grave. I'm digging my grave. My road to hell is surely paved.
Gunnison and seven of his men were dead in the attack. The bodies were retrieved later that day by the rest of the survivors. The eight who were found had their bodies mutilated, and the Mormon guide, 34-year-old William Washington Potter, was killed. 32-year-old Richard Hovenden Kern, who was the topographer, was one of the dead, and the German botanist Frederick Creutzfeldt and several other military privates were killed. And of course, the escape of the others is pretty harrowing. They claim to have driven their pack animals into exhaustion to retreat, spending the night with their dead animals. Anson Call tells the survivors he'll send a note to Ute Chief Kanosh to see about getting some of their trail notes and supplies back. And on October 30th, Kanosh shows up with 30 Utes and they promise to retrieve the scientific instruments and survey maps, and then Anson Call is going to go and bury the bodies.
Brigham Young sends old Emmett Huntington down to help, and it's claimed that the Mormons negotiate safe passage with Kanosh so that the soldiers can return safely to Salt Lake City.
So this is where it gets interesting. Newspapers around the country within 2 weeks are printing about how dangerous Indians in the West are and how they shouldn't have rights because of what happened. But by December, members of the Gunnison Group had talked with reporters and more accurate reports of what happened were being printed. Most controversially, Gentiles from Fort Bridger were circulating that there was no way that this was an Indian massacre, pointing out that the band didn't have guns yet. I think that they actually did, because they were trading. I think the Fort Bridger's guys were wrong about this.
Spaniards had brought those long.
But they claim, you know, they were shot with arrows, not with guns, so it couldn't be an Indian massacre. They pointed out that Indians in the area were fine with white settlers passing through. It was the Mormons they had a contentious relationship with. They pointed out the victims were also not scalped, which Pavant Utes did sometimes do, which Bridger's men believed was a sign that it was done by whites. So, unlike Gunnison's claims, Bridger's men believe Mormons didn't want the railroad because it would threaten their isolation. I'm going to quote from a pretty good dissertation by David Henry Miller in 1968. Has a few things wrong that have been updated, but while it's sympathetic to the Mormon view, it includes a lot of good details. So I'll link it too. He says, quote, "The editor of the Democrat, which was a paper, asserted that the Mormons had a strong motive for throwing the odium of the murder upon the Indians. For the Mormons, being at war with them, might justly hope that the United States would inflict a severe chastisement upon the guilty party, which would be, in effect, to fight the battle of the Mormons." But then the New York Times comes out and dismisses the Democrat story as utterly false.
So as the government back in Washington gets word that their officers are killed, they react in several ways. First, John Bernheisel, talked about him, the Mormon congressional delegate in Washington, goes on the defensive for Mormons, penning rebuttals to anyone claiming the Mormons did this. He demanded a full government investigation that he believed would exonerate the Mormons.
And Bernheisel, this is interesting, is particularly incensed that newspapers would dare claim that Mormons would dare don Indian garb to attack immigrants. Just wait a beat or two, dude. Like, 4 years from now, 1857, we'll show you that you need to calm down.
I agree. Bernheisel's being too loud. Brigham Young, meanwhile, sends his report of what happens, claiming it should be the official report. The government just doesn't respond to that, but the War Department sends Colonel Edward Steptoe with 175 soldiers and 150 civilian employees to Utah in 1854 to investigate the massacre. Oh, you don't like the first guys? Let's send like 10 times more dudes this time. Rumors were already beginning to circulate that this might not be an Indian massacre. And we'll talk about the Steptoe expedition coming up too, because it was contentious. The soldiers wintered in Salt Lake City, and let's just say Mormon men did not appreciate the competition that all these hot young soldiers from the East posed when it came to Mormon women. Ooh, look, a soldier. Yeah, that's not going to go well.
There's so many sermons where Brigham's like, "They will come into your homes and steal your women."
And he meant that quite literally. You know,
he like did say that. We'll talk about it soon.
So while he's there, Steptoe participated in the trial for the murder of Gunnison and his men and charged 8 Paiute men for the murders. And Steptoe was said to not be super pleased with the way the court did the proceedings.
And fun side note, later that year, there's this whole thing about the President of the United States, one Franklin Pierce, would try to convince Steptoe to replace Brigham Young as a federally appointed governor. And Steptoe's like, absolutely not. I will not take this job. I want a job somewhere else. And you're going to see why. He eventually leaves Utah with a complaint said to the federal government in the spring of 1855 that something is wrong. They need to send more troops to Utah to help control the Indians in southern Utah, who he believes are under Mormon control.
Then while
if only they would have listened. If
yeah, it's
only
funny.
They
it's like,
listened.
Well, we're going to start with just engineers, like 20 of them. And it's like, let's send like 300 dudes out. And then it's like, put another zero.
Here's the thing, though. The government wasn't better if they sent all these troops to put down Indians in southern Utah. someone was getting massacred.
Yeah. The indigenous tribes are all like, what if, now just hear me out, what if we don't send anyone and you all just go away? Please, is that an option?
Go back to Nauvoo.
So while Steptoe is there, Brigham Young invites him and his men that September to Salt Lake City to watch an execution of two Indians. And this was sold to Steptoe as being the first execution of its time. It's sold to Steptoe as being the first execution of its kind. It was in retaliation for something that had happened earlier in August. On August 8th, 1854, two Mormon boys named William and Warren Weeks were found scalped and mutilated after they went looking for firewood. These two were the sons of a local bishop in Cedar Valley, which is about 40 miles southwest of Salt Lake.
Brigham Young sent his guy, Dimmick Huntington, to find the killers of these little kids. And so two Goshutes, by the way, who didn't get along with some of the Mormons' friends like Wakar and Kanash, these Goshutes by the names of Longhair and Antelope were brought in for the crimes. And according to David Henry Miller, quote, the prosecution was handled by Joseph Holman, who was later to serve as prosecuting attorney in the Gunnison murder trial. The defense by Colonel Jesse Little and Hosea Stout, with George Washington Bean employed as Indian interpreter. Holman found the jury eager for a conviction and was not disappointed when the jury brought in a verdict of guilty as charged, and the two Goshute Indians were led to the gallows by George Washington Bean and accordingly executed.
Miller points out, quote, the eventual trial of the Indians accused of Gunnison's murder was perplexing. In light of the all-Mormon jury's incomprehensible verdict of manslaughter in the face of the court's charge to the jury to reach a verdict of either guilty or not guilty of murder in the first degree, Steptoe and several other non-Mormon officials were impelled to reach the conclusion that the trial had been nothing more than a farce, an attempt on the part of the church to show its contempt for the authority of the United States government and its representatives in Utah. And he's also upset the two Goshutes, enemies of Kanash, like we mentioned, would be killed for killing Mormon kids, but all of Kanash's men are let off the hook.
Yeah, so this Gunnison trial to charge these Pavant Utes is a shit show. I'm not joking. It's an absolute circus. So you've got Sylvester Mowry. We're going to talk about him in the Steptoe expedition. He's this young debonair soldier that nearly gets Brigham Young's married daughter-in-law to fall in love with him and run away with him. And since he's so close with Steptoe, this is used in the trial to show how gross the federal soldiers are, how they lack morals. And of course, Mowry accuses Mormon Almon Babbitt of tampering with witnesses, and there are accusations of impropriety all around, and the Mormons are sending witnesses to show up drunk in court, which is what the FLDS does sometimes now. And Kanash is called to the stand, and it's just like this deliberate nightmare. So Mowry is pissed at how this goes down, and he writes an op-ed to the New York Times with his acid pen. He writes several papers in the East with his acid pen, telling them that the Mormons were behind it all along. So no wonder Steptoe was frustrated and worried the entire thing was rigged. So Steptoe also immediately fires off a letter to Washington, telling them how hard it's been to investigate anything, and that he's having an extremely hard time sorting fact from fiction, and that the Mormons are disrupting justice with their shenanigans. He concludes, if the trial had been conducted fairly throughout, my mind would be clear on the subject, nor, as it is, am I prepared to advise further proceedings against them. The course of the jury, however, lamentable, should not probably be visited upon the more ignorant savages. In this connection, permit me to suggest again that a force be established somewhere to the south in order that the government may assume at once the entire control of these Indians. Until recently, they had been taught to believe that the Americans were feeble in comparison with the Mormons, and learned from me for the first time what a position the latter hold in our great national family. All right, do you remember at the top of the hour when I was granted a hall pass for a history rant? Let's return to that sentiment for a moment, and here's why this matters. Remember when a decent Mormon historian posited that John Gunnison and Albert Carrington were BFFs? That connection would be important to establish because depending on which reading you take of their letters depends how you interpret this next theory we're about to throw at you. This is a case of multiple readings of history.
By different interpretations, you mean the moral of the story is that everyone should have just listened to the Honorable Bishop Anson Call? If the government had listened to the Mormons, the Indians would have gotten upset. This is just the way things were in the Wild West, and Gunnison and his men were in the wrong place at the wrong time. It's just a tragedy. Or was it?
quote, "I have always held myself that the Mormons were the directors of my husband's murder," wrote Martha Gunnison, the engineer's widow, over the course of multiple letters to Judge W.W. Drummond, the 1855 federal appointee to the Supreme Court of Utah Territory. She claims that the Mormons were behind her husband's murder.
That's Associate Judge Drummond to you?
Yeah. We're not playing whose authority stick is the longest until we get Brigham Young ousted as governor. All right?
All right. So wait. By multiple interpretations of history, are you suggesting that Mormons leveraged their connection to the Utes and then used them as weapons against the federal government and any other outsiders when it was convenient for them? The Mormons might blame the massacres of whites that threatened their power on Ute bands? Where does that narrative sound familiar? All right. This is a big copycat of Mountain Meadows, just that it's 4 years earlier.
I don't know what you're implying, because as I was always taught, Brigham's policy with the Indians was always generous and progressive. He certainly wouldn't scapegoat anyone.
Miss Eddie Lee would beg to differ on them tender apples.
Okay, but seriously, I've talked to some of the direct descendants of the guys in this area, most famously Ryan Bundy, and they still, today, in the year of our Lord 2024, contend that the Book of Mormon scripture says that Native Americans are to be the arm of the Lord to use up the Gentiles. And where would they have learned that idea? Probably not from TikTok. And if I may, please raise my hand again for another chance to take a trip to the rant closet.
Only if you will invoke Will Bagley.
I would like to invoke Will Bagley. Listen, I know faithful scholars argue, rightly so, that Will Bagley had some strong biases. I read a BYU Review article the other day that came at him, and here's what it says, quote, "Bagley tries to support his fictional tale of a violent Mormon society by crediting the report of Judge William W. Drummond on murders committed by the Mormons. In a report that Norman Furness and other authorities believe probably tipped the balance in favor of sending the army to Utah, Drummond charged that the Mormons engineered the murders of territorial delegate Almon Babbitt, Captain John Gunnison, and Judge Leonidas Shaver. In spite of its flaws and prejudice, Bagley cites Drummond's report approvingly. In fact, Cheyennes killed Baba on the High Plains, Gunnison died at the hands of Pavant Utes, and Shaver died a natural death." End quote. Okay. This really spends my flower because, yes, we all have biases. Bagley, like myself, didn't like Brigham Young.
Wait, Will didn't like Brigham Young? Wait, you don't either? Shocked. I'm shocked, I tells you.
Let's just put it this way. If Brigham Young were running for governor today, I would not vote for him. How's that?
Biases.
I just like to vote for people who are elected fairly by an actual democratic process, is all. Anyway, later on, Bagley will be criticized for saying that there were little to no Paiutes at the Mountain Meadows Massacre, actual killings, and that Mormons were using power, threats, and violence to control them. And I have to say, there is a very fair interpretation of that history showing a repeating pattern of times when Mormons do seem to be doing, as Brother Bundy puts it, using them as the battle axe of the Lord. And I know it's popular in Mormon studies to act as if Mormons were some friendly co-conspirators with the Utes while they were actively stealing their land. And at best, I find that naive, and at worst, I find it dishonest. Okay, rant over.
If the going blows, I'm gonna wind up working in the thick of it. Sunshine through the rain and snow. There's an oily brine bilgewater
back. Back to Associate Judge Drummond for just a minute here. We're gonna give you more background on this guy soon in an upcoming episode, but let's get back to why John Gunnison's wife, Martha, was convinced the Mormons were responsible for their death. So Drummond arrived in Utah as this federal appointee in 1855. It's part of a longer story. He's also heard lots of rumors that Gunnison's death was ultimately the plan of the Mormons.
And let's be clear, when Gunnison first accepts this appointment to come back to Utah, he wrote to his wife that he was confident that the Mormons would leave him and his group alone because he thought that they'd be invested in a railroad line coming through. He really believed that they would want this and cooperate. And later on, Brigham Young submits to this and figures out how to handle it. But the railroad really does change Mormon economy and their businesses. So then Gunnison goes to Brigham Young and he reminds him how helpful he was after the Stansberry expedition and how he'd used his influence in Washington to argue for their cause. He even wrote a very fair book about them. It was very Thomas Kane of him. And then just to cover his bases, he also wrote the local agent of Indian Affairs informing them of the intentions because the Utes had been represented as hostile to him. But his letters begin to reflect more anxiety toward Mormon cooperation as he goes on. He's starting to get more suspicious.
The first real signs of trouble happen in early October when Gunnison's Ute Indian guide, Tevip Narayanta, left the expedition because he was really anxious about Gunnison's proximities to Mormon settlements. He writes his last letter before his death to his wife, describing how the Mormons seemed to be at war with the Indians.
And this is why it's so tricky to figure out who did what, because other accounts from the Gunnison survey reports have Anson Call not warning Gunnison of Indian tensions, but telling him that they were smoothed over and they didn't have to worry about it, that they were in the past. In fact, Gunnison's own soldier Beckworth records in their report that Anson Call actually guaranteed the safety of Gunnison and his men.
So yes, when Drummond gets here to investigate, Mormons hate him. And for lots of reasons. We'll get into that. He, along with Gunnison's wife, become convinced that the Mormons are behind this. This, of course, is dismissed as him being anti-Mormon, and because he has a prostitute with him openly acting as his mistress, the moral outrage about Drummond and the mistress.
He was like, wow. He was said to have said, like, oh, wow, I never thought I'd fall in love with a whore.
Wow. They really, of all the runaway officials, I think
didn't she sit on the stand with him?
Yes. And apparently in that sermon, when she's up on the stand, he tries to lecture them about morals and they're like, no dice, buddy.
As they're sitting there with their seven wives, you know, they're like, we married ours.
Well, you remember that was the rhetoric of polygamy. It was that
polygamy because, and prostitution.
Yes. If we don't do polygamy, then everyone will just have mistresses.
This is how they're like, took care of the widows.
This is the proof.
Think of the widows.
Yeah, they do not like him. But other agents had already been sent out by the government to investigate, and like E.J. Steptoe and Rufus Ingalls, Sylvester Mowry, Indian agent Garland Hurt, John Kinney, John Holman, Drummond obviously, and David Burr, all felt like the Mormons are behind this. And most of those other guys did not have mistresses with them.
And there were rumors, real rumors, that John D. Lee and several of his men dressed as Indians and raided the Gunnison group on purpose. Not only to scare the agents and send a message to the United States Army, but also to steal their stuff, get intel on what they really thought about the Mormons in their reports, and to establish dominance with the Pavants. And I have to say, this is definitely Lee's MO. But it's really tricky. There's so much controversy around so many of these accounts, accusations, and motives. It's really hard to tell. Like, there's a very clear reading that says that the Mormons were behind this. And there's also a really clear reading that they weren't. And maybe that, you know, the immigrants were up to shenanigans. So who do you think killed Gunnison and his men?
It is hard because if you say the Mormons are behind it, that's several options. Like Mountain Meadows, does that mean that it was directly involved and directly carried out by Mormons? Does that mean it was directed by but not carried out by Mormons? Does that mean it was implied by Mormons? Does it mean there were conditions put in place by Mormons that sort of naturally lead to this happening? Lots of options, and honestly, I don't know.
Well, I guess we'll end with this. We don't know. The official histories of Utah place this on the Pavants. And according to the BLM, quote, the site of the massacre was added to the National Registry of Historic Places in 1976. A stone monument marks the spot where the massacre occurred. To get to it, travel west from Delta on Highway 50 and several miles past Hinckley to a road sign that marks the turnoff. Go south about half a mile to the marker. Because of vandalism, the plaque describing the event was moved to the Great Basin Museum in Delta.
The goddess on the mountaintop was burning like a silver flame, the summit of beauty and love, and the Books of Mormon's report was her name, powered by Benchmark Books. So for the Stansberry Expedition, check out Exploring the Great Salt Lake, the Stansberry Expedition of 1849-50 by Brig Madsen, published by the U of U Press. If you can agree in your heart that perhaps they weren't all best friends, then I think you'll enjoy this treatment. It's unfortunately out of print and getting a little bit harder to find, but I know some people, and they can help you out with that. Now, we also need a bio of Albert Carrington, and if the title of it is not A Little Folly in Israel, then somebody's going to get fired. There's also a summary article on the expedition, also by Madsen, called Stansberry's Expedition to the Great Salt Lake, 1849-50, in the Utah Historical Quarterly. Also in the quarterly is John W. Gunnison's letters to his Mormon friend Albert Carrington. Y'all can read the letters, and then you can judge for yourself what was up. As always, you can get these and everything else in the Mormon universe at Benchmark Books. Check out Benchmark in Salt Lake City or at benchmarkbooks.com.
Brother Young.
offering for my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young, a blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. 'Cause I sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young. Let only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com and consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.